You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is John Edgar Wideman, the author, most recently, of The Cattle Killing, published by Houghton Mifflin. He is the editor as well of this year's Best American Short Stories, 1996. The Cattle Killing seems to me to be Wideman's densest and most complex book. The initial metaphor that struck me for discussion when I finished it was the idea of transmission. The book begins with an author leaving a writing conference full of narratologists to cross Philadelphia to go to his father's house, which is filled with patches of stagnant water, with the intention of reading to him alone. And the book ends with a letter from the author's son giving a review of sorts of the book and adding a letter. The question of who is telling the story, how is it transmitted, and who is listening seems to be central to this novel. Can you speak about that?
I think that not only is it central to the novel in precisely the ways you've described as a framing device, but it's central to my concept of love, which for me is one of the overarching pieces of the structure and one of the themes that I want to explore. Because in some ways, my unnamed 18th century preacher, itinerant preacher, who is the central character, he is like Scheherazade. It's a Scheherazade-like story. He's in love with a woman. She seems to be failing fast, at least physically. And so the way he keeps her alive is by going and telling her stories. That's how he becomes her doctor, her savior. But of course, when he tells her these stories, another outcome is that he stays alive. Mm-hmm. And so they mutually reinforce one another through these stories. And in an important sense, the stories are what make them real. The stories are what make them real, give them life for one another.
The book has also the idea that it doesn't exactly matter who the body is who is being told the story, because there is the idea that certain spirits travel from body to body, inhabiting them, and ultimately the book is full of people who are both tellers and told. At the ultimate level, in this book, everyone is everyone.
Without driving my readers bananas or the people who are listening to us bananas, yes. I mean, that's so. I believe there is some spirit that in fact belongs to all of us, and some spirit that allows us to identify both the best and worst in one another, because we know that spirit is in itself, is in ourselves, excuse me. Again, going back to the theme of love. Love for me is probably in a very real way something that can never be consummated, because the truest kind of love is the attempt to capture or embrace the spirit, which as long as one is a body, you're not going to be able to do. They just don't blend. They can dance with one another. They can make music together, but they can't. They're different. They're different substances. And so my preacher is sort of doomed in his quest to capture the African woman he finds on the road, because what he really needs, wants, desires, is her spirit. And he's like you and like me. He gets confused. He thinks it's the body that he wants.
Now, there are many references braided through this book to ideas about art. And I wanted to start with the one that's virtually at the center of the novel. This narrator arrives virtually dead, frozen in snow, at the house of a black and white couple, George Stubbs and his wife. They bring the narrator back to life by sleeping on both sides of him. And we discover that the woman has been the wife of the artist George Stubbs. Her husband was their slave. They've come to America, but now there's a very interesting question that goes on. Stubbs, the painter, painted anatomies revealing the truths about the workings of the cadaver, the human body, bought bodies from body salesmen, terrifyingly rendered, by the way, painted the horses that his father eviscerated and cut apart, the cattle. There is the sense that art is what happens, is what's made by the sons of the capitalists. That art, at least for the Stubbs family, is something that is a consequence of victimization, tyranny, imperialism. It's one of the models for art in the book. The book is full of warnings against false prophets, false artists, beginning with its epigraph from Ezekiel. And I wanted to ask you about the incorporation of negative forms of art within the book.
Well, your word braided is a very interesting word, because we braid whips, we braid lovely locks of hair, and it also suggests the kind of intricate weaving that I feel is part of most of what I understand in the world. You know, babies are great and babies are also terrifying. So braiding it is, and being a writer, being an artist is a scary business for me, because... many becauses. In this book, some of the becauses that I've foregrounded have to do with trying to express through art anything about race, for instance, and trying to capture the quicksilver truths of human interaction, human speech. Trying to capture what is essentially spiritual activity in some sort of material form. So the best art plays a really risky game, because it is reductionist. You know, you're trying to catch the butterfly and reproduce the butterfly, and many of the ways that artists do that, or schools of art do that, you have to kill the butterfly first and take it apart. And then it's a question of simulating life, and even Plato a long time ago was worried about that process. You know, when you simulate life and you create counter realities and copies, aren't you lying? And if you lie well enough, won't you corrupt people? And so the question of how art relates to capital, the huge fortunes that have been accumulated by capitalists is a very vexed question. Is art always going to be a kind of sideshow? Is it going to be bread and circuses for the masses to keep us distracted? So the artist is always on the edge of corruption. And that's a careful choice of words, because when Stubbs painted, his nose was 2 inches from corruption because he was always doing cadavers. So these things are all, I don't know whether I'm being clear at all, but they're matters which I worry about and matters which I try to represent in the novel. I don't have any conclusions, but I do feel the sense of jeopardy as artists trying to capture such intricate, complex things and make them available, which could be seen as a kind of commodification or exploitation always.
I'm speaking to John Edgar Wideman about his new novel, The Cattle Killing, published by Houghton Mifflin. Now, I have the feeling that there is a current generation of fiction in captivity. That right now there's a great deal of very impressive gay writing, Latino writing, black writing, and when it's discussed in public, it's discussed as if it were innocent art. I know, for instance, that once I was at a reading with you, we were on stage, you had read a section of a new piece that entirely avoided the subject of race. When I asked you to read a section of another book, at first you demurred. And it's my sense that the writing that is being done now is being done for a future generation, so that when people eventually take the books from the shelf, they discover that a discussion that has not been able to take place in public has been taking place on the pages of novels, in essays, in the intellectual forum, if not in the actual world. Does that ring any bells for you?
I think I'm following. I think I'm following. You correct me if I'm not, but there is a kind of balkanization in art right now, and in the discussion of art, not only in the popular press. It's infuriating in the popular press when, for instance, the headline of a review of my book will say, Weidman tackles the black experience. Uh-huh. Aside from being a rather mixed metaphor there. if The Cattle Killing is anything, it's crying out to be a chronicle of the American experience, of what happened to us. Now, the focus is through the eyes of African-American people, and the plight of Africans in the early colonial society is the way I'm measuring and trying to make sense of this collective experience. But for the headline of a review and then the body of it, to try to figure out what I'm saying about the black experience, and am I angry or not angry, and then using the art, using a piece of criticism as an outlet for that person's, the writers, the critics' attitudes about race, is what happens on the popular level, and that's simply infuriating and wrong, and it adds to that balkanization. You go in a bookstore, and not too long ago there were sections that would break up literature into those categories, and then there are the people like myself who get stuck because they're not black enough for the black section and not white enough for the white section, and there you go. So I think we're talking about some of the same things. But even in the question of high criticism, and even in the realm of high criticism, you have this movement which is very clear in structuralism and in some of the French modernist thinking, and in the American watered down versions of that the body of the author is being removed. You know, we talk about the text, and the text is now presumed to be authorless. Just when we were getting our foot in the door, just when we were beginning to say, uh-huh, this is the African American experience from an African American point of view, pay attention. They're saying it doesn't matter who wrote this thing. All that matters is what we have to say about it, and the author is kind of just a figment of people's imagination. So we're being depersonalized. We're losing agency once more. An agency that we really never securely gained. So all this stuff is mixed up, I think, in what you're talking about. And if you have a way out of it, if you have some strategies to fight it, I'd love to hear them.
Well, it does seem that you are in this book incorporating some of the strategies inherent upon the death of the author. That is to say, that if the author is no longer embodied, but is a spirit, in a sense, representing the zeitgeist in language, mm-hmm, depersonalized. This book seems to be a kind of seance or calling of spirits in which stories upon stories, voices within voices, that the book ventriloquizes itself ultimately, that the ultimate narrator calls himself I, but he, in addition to being the first person pronoun I, thinks of himself as EYE and AY and AIE, that there's a vast evanescence. And in a sense, the mist that covers a lake in which consciousness is born virtually at the beginning of this book, so that the person who went to sleep by a lake and now seeing just mist says, where is the lake? And the question becomes, what happens when the content, the lake, disappears and is replaced by an emanation?
I think that one can try to grasp what the phenomenon I believe you're describing in a lot of different ways. One simple metaphor for me, or one simple parallel, is the blues singer, who in the midst of a song is very self-referential, and will take you out of the song for a minute. I'm tired tonight. Ba-dong, 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 ba-dong. I'm tired, folks. You ever walk down a road and your feet get hard and your feet sore and you the fly around your neck and pat, you slap that sucker, and then you go on and bong, 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 then he plays more song. He is saying there's a person singing to you always. This is a song, and there are times when I want you to just hear the song and pat your foot, and that's what we're here for. But on the other hand, it's important to me that you remember that this song is something that has to do with a real life, my life. And if you want to take that a little further, it has to do with your life also, because here we are on this occasion. And I think that's so beautifully rendered and so simply rendered in the blues tradition, or in the tradition of African oral storytelling, and I'm sure in other people's storytelling traditions. But that focus on the I, as a floating signifier, but one that is very concrete, and one that you can't have the art, you can't have the blues song, you can't have the story in its fullest sense unless you, both audience and artist, remember and memorialize that I, refer to it. I'm not kidding anybody. My song wouldn't work unless you sat down to listen to it.
Now, in that line, can you explain in general terms how this narrative gains access to the dream of the woman who told the Zosians to kill their cattle? Because it's the paradigmatic act of betrayal that comes from within the culture, but it comes from a place that the story has not gone. It's as if this has entered consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do. Number one, I believe that things do enter consciousness. I think that's as good an explanation as any. Where did relativity come from? Where did race come from? I mean, in one way, you could probably trace the history of it, and that's what Foucault tries to do. But if something doesn't exist, we invent it. If we need it, if a society needs it, if consciousness needs it, we sort of invent it. It's no coincidence that in very high-powered physics, people are talking about simultaneous universes, and that people are arguing about how the universe starts. I mean, that's an idea that came from somewhere, and if that kind of idea can just appear, then, my little Hossa story, it's in the air also. I do, at the very beginning of the novel, probably about 30 pages in or so, the narrator, in a little aside, is saying, he lives outside of Philadelphia, and he says that he knows about the plague and the fact that the Black folk in Philadelphia are catching hell, being impressed in gangs of nurses and undertakers to save the city from the plague. He knows all about this, but he says his white neighbors don't seem to, and he says, but my Black acquaintances do. And he said, I wonder why that happens. He said, I wonder why one group knows and the other doesn't. And the only answer he can come up, he says something about ancient excitability of our blood, refined by the travel by the tribal drum, something like that. Now, I don't want to get into sort of Jungian archetypes, because that's just, those get us in trouble. But on the other hand, some things that are very complex do have a simple explanation. There are cultures that refine the eye. Everything is organized around seeing, the metaphors and the like. And there are others that hear. You know, in Europe, you say, I see, when you mean I understand. In African culture, you say, I hear. I hear you. You hear me. That means, do you understand me? Do you comprehend? And I think you can, in that sense, perhaps listening to music, to stories, to the pulse, to the blood in one another, provides a channel where some ideas like the cattle killing in South Africa might come.
There is, throughout this book, things that go by the same name, the Stubbs, husband and wife, that are quite different. Black people with white people's names, white people with black people's names, preachers who are preaching to preachers. There is the sense that always underground, things are not what they seem. The beautiful orphanage is in its basement a place where at least one child is experiencing a diminution of life entirely. Mm-hmm. And when he asks what is a teacher, is given the answer, which for him is true, a teacher is death. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about things referring ultimately to their opposites, which seems systematic here.
As much fun as it is to feel that I have a kind of control, and that the front brain is always working when I write fiction, it's just not true. It's often a question of the unconscious. It's often a question of promptings that I then edit and try to make sense of. But I know that I'm trying to get into the book my sense of my senses of life, my profound skepticism on the one hand, which says, don't believe a damn thing you see, don't believe a word you hear. In a minute it could be its opposite. The bottom can fall out, and that's all scary stuff to me, and I've had to deal with that my whole life. Part of it comes from growing up black and poor. Part of it comes from just being a sentient human being. Just check some stuff out, and it ain't easy out there. But the other part is a kind of wonder and excitement, because if the bottom falls out, then what? You know, what's going to be down there?
Well, the linkage of opposites seems to become the nature of this novel style. I'm talking to John Edgar Wideman about his book, The Cattle Killing, but very early on, light is described as something that you can hear. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem accidental that later in the book there is a blind woman and that sound is her light. That there is an interest in this book of bringing as much synesthesia to bear as possible. That is to say, that things seen should be described in oral or olfactory terms, that there is an attempt to take discrete elements and describe them in outer spheres that link them in every direction in a pulse of association, that the prose has a strategy of wanting consistently to link opposites, darkness and light, sound and silence, light and sound. It seems to be the book's desire to alter the way in which experience is received.
I stand convicted. I mean, absolutely. I don't want to. There's no reality that I'm trying. No static or privileged reality that I'm trying to represent in the book. In fact, if I'm trying to do anything, I want to throw out to the reader the knowledge and the opportunity to create the world as you go along. I don't want to have a bunch of givens and then let the novel proceed from these assumptions and givens. I want to in a dynamic way, start with something like, well, what is a man and what is a woman? The questions that I ask at the very end of the book, what is a man, what is a woman, are really the questions that the book poses implicitly from the very beginning. So that when someone looks into a window and sees something in there, it might be a person, it might be a wolf, it might be a blanket. There's a lot of those might-bes, ors, or maybes, or could-bes, or synesthesia. I want to highlight the scariness and the joy of creating your world, and in fact, the way we create it. You know, I think early on we get help through language to identify things. We get help through rules and laws and social conditioning, and all that's necessary, or you go nuts. But on the other hand, each one of those times, each assumption, each system that's imposed on us removes some of the beauty. That's why I'm interested in a blind woman, because she can't relate into the world the way most people do. So she has to do some inventing. If you get into her head, then you will be able to experience how the world might be put together, starting with a different set of senses. To me, one of the most marvelous things in the world is a dog's nose, and I just can't figure out what it would look like, how to create a three-dimensional space the way a dog does in the morning when it takes sniffs in the air. It knows the rabbit's been here. It knows things about time. It knows things about the total environment. And I've often wondered, you know, what a strange and miraculous world to live in if your nose could do that. And I guess at some stage we were much better at that. And then our we use language and our sight. And the olfactory vision faded. Vision, there you go. You can't even have to use a metaphor because we don't even know what it is anymore. I don't want to become a primitive, but on the other hand, I want in the book to suggest that life is active. That
adjoining perception the senses. Is active. Yes, yes. I've been speaking to John Edgar Wideman. The new novel, The Cattle Killing, has been our subject of conversation. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.